KALW. From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I'm from Pacific Heights.
I live in Fremont.
I live in Russian Valley in the Richmond District.
I live in the Inner Sunset.
I live in the Outer Sunset.
Coming up, former Police Commission President Susie Loftus on why she should be San Francisco's next top cop.
There is a lot of consensus that change needs to start now.
Then we hear about a BART director's attempt to stop panhandling on BART.
Our riders are not voluntarily watching them. They are forced to.
And a Mountain View gathering this weekend wants to connect Silicon Valley to Africa.
When I was there for a few days, I just spoke to people. I literally planted myself in a cafe, and I had startup after startup just come and talk to me.
The Bay Area African Tech Connection coming up on Cross Currents. Well, a lot of the Bay Area is without electricity today as PG&E starts its power shutoff plan to prevent wildfires. Many schools around the Bay are closed, including universities, UC Berkeley, Mills College, and Sonoma State. We want to hear from you. How are the outages affecting you? Call us and leave us a message at 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. Or send us a voice memo to news@kalw.org. Include your name and location, and we may play your message on the show. Well, the race for San Francisco's district attorney is proving to be one of the city's most surprising races in recent memory. A few days before early voting opened this week, Mayor London Breed appointed Susie Loftus as interim DA. Loftus is a former San Francisco Police Commission president. She also worked for Kamala Harris in the state attorney general's office and San Francisco's district attorney office. She's expected to resign from her current role with the San Francisco Sheriff's Office and begin her tenure as interim DA later this month. But it's still up to voters to decide in November whether she should keep the post for good. KALW Justice reporter Holly J. McDeed recently spoke with Loftus about her vision for the prosecutor's office.
So the big news, of course, as far as the San Francisco DA's race goes, is that Mayor Breed has recently appointed you interim DA after George Gascon's abrupt resignation. Before that appointment, this was going to be the first DA's race in the city without an incumbent running in over 100 years. How do you respond to critics who say this appointment tips the scales in your favor in a way that interferes with the democratic process?
You know, what I would say is that the voters of San Francisco are going to decide who the next district attorney is. And I've been running and making the case to them for over a year that I think we fundamentally need to take a different approach that is grounded in building safety in all of our neighborhoods and making a justice system that works for all of us. So over the last year, I have really built a broad coalition of support from not only the mayor, but eight members of the Board of Supervisors, every person we've elected to go to Sacramento, our governor, because I think there is a lot of consensus that change needs to start now. So when this appointment unexpectedly came up, my whole career has been about stepping up to serve, and I'm going to step in as the interim. But some of the classic benefits of incumbency, like, you know, saying I'm the district attorney as my ballot designation, I don't have any of those benefits. So I'm continuing to make the case to the voters every day about why I think I'm the right person with the experience to make the change that everybody wants to see in our city.
Yeah, and so during the couple of weeks where you will be interim district attorney, do you have plans for that period?
I do. You know, I think the you know, change starts now. It's really important to stabilize the office, make sure the office has what it needs. Having been a courtroom prosecutor, I understand how difficult elections can be on the folks working there. So my priority is going to be assessing how things are, identifying, you know, the few areas that I think we can immediately make improvements. I do want to make sure that the office is more grounded in community.
Right. Yeah. And so most of your background has been in law enforcement. And of course, you led the police commission during a turbulent time for San Francisco police. This was a time where former police chief Greg Suhr ultimately resigned over a spate of officer-involved shootings. There was a scandal involving racist and homophobic text messages as well. What did you learn about police accountability during your time on the commission, and how would you apply those lessons to the DA's office?
During my time on the police commission, I did three really important things. One is I got every patrol officer to have a body-worn camera, which helps us in this idea of accountability and getting to the truth of what happens. The second thing is I terminated more officers for serious misconduct than had been done before, and because I think it's very important to hold police accountable and demonstrate that if you lose the public trust, you lose your job, and that is what I was able to do on the police commission. And then the last piece is, with all of these shootings that happened of civilians, we recognize that that is the very worst thing that can happen, to destroy the trust we work so hard to build between communities, in particular communities of color and law enforcement. So I led a process to reform the use of force policy for the first time in 20 years in San Francisco for the police department. I took on a big fight with the Police Officers Association, was targeted in ads and radio ads and television ads. But ultimately, I stood strong, and as a result, we prevailed in court, and that policy was implemented. And 3 years after its implementation, there was a 30% reduction in use of force by San Francisco police officers, and also a reduction in injuries to officers. So what I learned about police accountability is that it's essential to holding the public trust if an officer commits misconduct. And it's also essential that we make sure our rules are clear, that we have a community standard when it comes to use of force. And that community standard that we created in San Francisco became one of the bases for Assemblymember Shirley Weber's bill AB 392 in Sacramento, which went on to change the rules for the entire state. So the work that was done here in San Francisco, largely, you know, made possible by activists and people who demanded change, was something that has led to meaningful change. And I think it's something we continue to build on.
Looking more broadly to your plans, if elected DA, what are some of your biggest priorities for the, say, first year on the job?
The civil rights unit is a big priority of mine. We have to have a unit that helps us demonstrate that what it means to be a progressive prosecutor is not just what we don't do anymore, but it's what we do. And we have to stand up and make sure that the prosecutor is the people's lawyer, the person looking out to protect our consumer rights and our environmental rights, and standing up when workers are having their wages stolen. Too often across this campaign, many people who've jumped on board to support me have said, look, Susie, I'm supporting you as DA because I've never thought the DA could do anything for me or for my community. But with you, I believe you'll stand up for all of us, not just for some of us. A second piece of the civil rights unit is we have to tackle racial disparities in our criminal justice system. If we don't do that, we're not going to have a city that's safe for everyone. And when we have 5% of our population who are African-American, and yet we have 53% of who's in our jail is African-American, we have a crisis that we have to start undoing and identifying all the places where racial disparities are popping up in our system, and we have to eradicate them piece by piece and really talk about making sure that this is a system that doesn't unfairly target, portions of our community. So that's a big priority of mine, as well as I said, getting neighborhood prosecutors partnering with our community members on how we can build safety neighborhood by neighborhood in San Francisco.
That was Susie Loftus. She's the interim San Francisco District Attorney. She spoke with KALW's justice reporter Holly J. McDeed. Loftus is running as a candidate in the upcoming race for DA. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. If you're a regular BART rider, your ride has probably been interrupted at some point by folks playing instruments, rapping, dancing, or all of the above. This month, BART's board of directors will be considering a ban on aggressive panhandling, which might effectively put an end to busking on board. So what do the performers think, and what about the public? KALW's Porfirio Rangel has the scoop.
It's a busy morning on BART. It's not packed, but everyone is in their own little world. People are reading books, listening to music with earbuds, or on their phone. A few minutes after leaving the station, someone from the middle of the car makes an announcement.
Good morning, everybody. I'm Drew Money, the young, humble billionaire.
The greeting gets people's attention, and for a few minutes, some of them take their eyes off their phone and take their earbuds out. The guy has a mic on hand with a small speaker beside him.
I want to perform a song for you beautiful, beautiful people. I want you guys to feel good, like real, real good.
If you've been on BART, you've probably seen a performer on board. They rap, they dance, and they're part of what makes Bay Area culture.
I want to receive love, so I'm going to give love. And I appreciate each and every one of you guys.
Drew Money, a.k.a. the young humble billionaire, plays a beat from his phone and starts rapping.
I give the world my all, even my kidney. I'm not kidding, but you see what I'm getting at. I know when you give the love that you'll get it back. No, picture that.
He seems to be enjoying himself, and people cheer. After he's done, he thanks the crowd and walks up and down the aisle with a small blue container collecting money.
Picture that. Thank you all, much love. Thank you guys.
If one BART director has her way, this will be banned.
Our riders are not voluntarily watching them. They are forced to. They're on their ride from one place to another, and they are forced to watch whatever goes on the train.
At a BART director's meeting on August 22nd, Deborah Allen, who represents District 1 in Contra Costa County, proposed a ban on all forms of solicitation for money, including performers. I'm curious what BART riders think about these on-the-go shows.
Some of it can be annoying, but like if I see people that are playing music or something, I feel, okay, that's okay.
If they perform, I mean, I don't think of it as bad because they're not like forcing you to pay them.
I don't like it at all. I just want them to go away.
I'm comfortable with it as long as there's no pressure to pay.
Currently, BART has a zero-tolerance policy for aggressive panhandling, which is defined as the solicitation of donations in an unreasonably insistent, threatening, intimidating, or intrusive manner. But there is nothing in place for non-aggressive panhandling and performing for donations, and Allen wants to change that. But her proposal has caught the attention of the ACLU of Northern California. They believe it's a violation of free speech protected under the First Amendment. The civil rights organization cite a preliminary injunction they won against the city of Sacramento. However, Allen responds by saying that that ordinance applied only to public transit areas. Her proposal is designed for the areas in between the gates and trains where you have to pay to get in. To get an idea of how big the issue is, in 2017, BART received about 1,500 complaints when it came to panhandling. In 2018, the number rose to 2,000. The young humble billionaire has been busking on BART since November 2018.
I started performing on BART when I needed to pay rent and what I was normally doing for work wasn't busy. I already had a speaker because I always dreamed of like just going out and performing in public. So at this point where I had to, I was like, I'm just going to go out and perform, and I used to live right next to BART stations.
It depends on his schedule when he performs on BART, but on a normal day, he can be at it all day from 10 to 10, and he's proud of what he does.
It feels good to spread positive energy, and people are receptive of it. People tell me all the time that they appreciate me and to keep going and keep on writing positive music. Can't get on BART and ride Embarcadero to West Oakland and not want to see a dancer. And it's powerful what they do because they're spreading positive energy as well. I definitely think it's part of Bay Area culture.
the young Humble billionaire doesn't think Bart is trying to go after buskers.
I think they're more likely trying to ban panhandling, and the buskers kind of got looped into it as well. I just feel like a lot of people crap on homelessness in this area.
He doesn't seem to worry about the ban passing.
I don't think it'll affect me too much at all. I think I would still go out and do my thing.
The riders on this day seem to be split on the ban.
I wouldn't support the ban because these people aren't really like doing anything bad.
Yeah, I guess I would, because you know, you're just trying to get to your destination. And
I don't think a ban would be effective. People are still going to do it. So no, I wouldn't like actually support it.
No. I mean, what would be the purpose of banning people from asking for money on, like, who does that benefit?
The BART board of directors will be discussing the details of the proposed ban at a meeting in October, and the public will have a chance to weigh in then. In Oakland, I'm Porfirio Arango for Cross Currents.
That story was produced with help from Julia Linus Goodman. This is Cross Currents. I'm Henat Baba. So BART may not take you to Mountain View just yet, but that's our next stop on today's show. This weekend is the Innovate for Africa conference, connecting African entrepreneurs and innovators to Silicon Valley. Cities like Lagos, Nigeria, and Nairobi, Kenya have rapidly growing tech sectors. And for the main organizer of the gathering, it's personal. San Jose resident Hiba Sharif is originally from Sudan. She's been in tech here for more than 15 years and has been named one of Silicon Valley Business Journal's 40 Under 40. She recently launched her own company, Elevoro, that focuses on growing tech skills in underserved communities. And Hiba wants to see her country join the African tech revolution. She just got back from a trip to Sudan, speaking to young entrepreneurs there, and joins me in studio.
I think everybody has a perception or a perceived misconception that Africa is in, you know, dire need for help, and they need, you know, there's hunger, and, you know, people ask me, do you have camels and lions and stuff, and do we have electricity? And I'm like, are you kidding me? We have the fastest, you know, networks, you know, 5G came there before it went anywhere. Mm-hmm. You know, when people hear that I am in Silicon Valley, they're like, oh, you're around all these talented people and all these brilliant minds. And I'm sitting there and I'm like, but top talent is everywhere. You know, it's not. Yes, there are many people that come who come to Silicon Valley because they're talented. Right. And they get the greatest educations and create these cool startups and innovation. And there's the structure. Right. Mm-hmm. The infrastructure, the system is in place to promote it and to serve as a catalyst, as an accelerator. But the mind. Right. The talent itself is everywhere. I went and I met with amazing folks from Impact Hub, where I had a little session with some of the founders there. I met with an organization called Yalla Nbadir, who created Yalla Hub, which is another kind of accelerator, incubator. Mm-hmm. Everybody's so thirsty for knowledge, thirsty to, like, you know, advance and do something. And the 23 and 24-year-olds that I'd met have been working in social enterprises for 7 and 8 years. Mm. You know, just hearing their stories and hearing the startups, if it's agricultural technology solutions, if it's smart homes, if it's AI-based technologies, if it's a company. Again, one of the founders is 24 years old and was helping. So the organizations, they created two organizations, one called Hudhud and one called Mahabba. And one is a nonprofit that helps teach women how to make bags and creates a program. And the other is the for-profit that sells the bags to fund, right, the program that teaches people, right? So it's one of these, again, social ventures. But this all came about because these 24-year-old medical doctors, mind you, saw that women were being thrown in prison for not being able to afford to pay their rent. and their rent of 100 Sudanese pounds, which is equivalent to less than $2, was something they couldn't pay, and they would just get jailed for not having good economic status. And then how does that help anyone? Because they're in jail and they can't make any money, and they get ripped out of their family. So she started to raise awareness on Facebook, raise funds to get them out of prison. And she kind of helped 120 plus women do that just on her own.
One individual,
mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Used tech and innovatively did that. So what I did when I was there for a few days, I just spoke to people. I literally planted myself in a cafe, and I had startup after startup just come and talk to me. Mm-hmm. And the amount of feedback and love that I'm getting just for giving them my 2 cents is invaluable to them. Mm-hmm. And so what it's made me do is realize that I have to do more of that. I have to get more of the folks who are interested in helping
here,
right? Folks that share those values, right?
Right.
And are willing to give up an hour of their time, or maybe $500 of their bank accounts, of their, you know, very, very large bank accounts, and just contribute. And I'll call it an investment. It's not a donation we're mm-hmm. asking for, right? And
is that the key there, to not call it a donation?
Let's not call it donation.
To make sure they understand you're getting back something, or what is that?
It
feels like a very fine line to have to dance, to convince people here that, you know, in addition to doing the right thing and helping people, there is something coming back to you.
Yeah, because we're not giving people fish. We're teaching them how to fish, right? So that's the difference. It's that we're not actually giving our time to giving money to get someone out of jail. No, right? It's because they're going to just end up back in jail. They don't have money to pay for their rent, so they're going to get back into prison. So how do we empower them to create, to give them an opportunity to work and figure out how to make their own money, right? Or make their lives a little easier? Because again, the talent is there, right? Mm-hmm. The minds are there. Mm-hmm. They just have no access to education, no access to opportunities. If there's no power, there's no internet. Like, you know what I mean? It's actually just very, very powerful stuff, and would not take much effort or time. I mean,
so let's talk about the conference.
Yes.
This inaugural Innovate for Africa. What is it? What are you planning to do at the conference? What's your goal?
We are bringing founders, investors, and a variety of different entrepreneurs from Africa to Silicon Valley to meet with and connect with a community of like-minded, skilled, talented people in Silicon Valley who are also entrepreneurs and VCs and so on. So, and potential hires, mm-hmm. because the hiring piece goes both ways, right? So maybe there are opportunities in Africa for folks who are here and want to contribute, to your point. Some people want to go back, right? Maybe there are opportunities here that are available to folks in Africa, building a community, mm-hmm. right? We want people to know that if they do want to go to Africa, mm-hmm. if they want to take their business to Africa, if they want to just learn more, if they want to help, support, donate, whatever it is, or invest, as I say, then they know where to go.
Hiba Sharif is CEO of Elevoro, and she's organizing the Innovate for Africa conference. That's this weekend at the Computer History Museum in Mountain View. You can find the details at kelw.org. Now let's listen to some local music. This is Blue Ocean from Oakland. They're performing at the Hit Gallery in San Francisco Saturday afternoon. Today's Cross Currents team includes Janae Darden, Imran Ali Malik, Lisa Morehouse, Marissa Ortega Welch, True Quinn, and Joshua Sirotiak. Our engineers are James Rollins, Tariq Foda, and Gabe Graben. Content manager is Shirin Adil. Our managing editor is David Boyer. Deputy news director is Angela Johnston. News director is Ben Trevney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.